This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
We're back with more Radio EcoShock. At first, I thought Dr. Joe Alton and his wife, Nurse Amy, were kind of fringe characters. Having met Joe and listened to his story, I've changed my mind. Here we go. This is Alex Smith. We're at the Mother Earth News Fair with yet another really interesting interview coming up, I think, with Dr. Joe Alton. Dr. Joe has some ideas about how we could all be prepared to look after each other if we run into an emergency. If you think that's far-fetched, I don't think so. Just think about Katrina. There was no medical help for 3 days. Whatever was there was what was there, so maybe it's best we all learn more about how to look after our bodies. So Dr. Joe Alton, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. I'm very honored to be here. Thank you for inviting me, Alex.
So you do your own radio program, you do books under the label of Doom and Bloom. Why do you call it that?
Well, originally, it's funny, we started because we're master gardeners for the state of Florida, and we were originally going to do a gardening site. And so it was going to be survival and medicinal gardening. And then we found out that so many people were interested in getting medical education and finding out what they could do in the event of a disaster, let's say, or if they lived in a remote setting where help was not immediately on the way. They really wanted some of this medical information. And for us, it was sort of having to think out of the box because there's a sort of secrecy in the medical establishment. They really don't want a lot of the regular people to know about the things that we do, how to, let's say, suture a wound, when you should close a wound, when you should leave a wound open, things like that. And we found that the demand for that kind of knowledge was so great that we decided to go out on a limb and try to make people better medical assets than they are now. We don't hand them medical diplomas, and we don't tell them to, if they need a brain transplant, and there's a hospital with a brain surgeon nearby, we want them to not try to do it themselves. But we do want them to be better resources for their family in times of trouble or in remote settings than they are now.
And you don't just call yourself a doctor. You're a real doctor. Would you tell us about your qualifications?
I'm a medical doctor, MD, and I am a fellow of the American College of Surgeons and the American College of OBGYN. When I was young, I delivered a lot of babies, and as you get older, you sort of morph into a pelvic surgeon, so to speak. So everything below the belly button, I can take you apart and put you back together.
And you work with your wife, Amy. Tell us about Amy.
My lovely wife, Amy, is an advanced registered nurse practitioner, and she was a certified nurse midwife as well. So she also delivered a lot of babies and worked in local university hospitals and taught at local nursing schools.
Now, what sets you apart from some doctors is that you apparently believe that we could run into a serious breakdown in society, and you're not alone in that. A lot of my listeners also believe that. So tell us about that.
Well, you know that there are many different disasters that could befall us. Just this week, we saw a tragedy of people dying in tornadoes. Two women died in floods in San Antonio, Texas. I mean, there's always the chance of natural disasters that could befall us in this area of Washington. I believe you're on some earthquake faults, and there's a risk of flooding sometimes. So I think that it's really important to understand that even if a particular disaster has a very, very small chance of occurring, that there's so many different types of things that can happen, both natural and man-made types of disasters, that what is the chance that none of these things is going to happen to you or maybe your children in your lifetime or their lifetimes. And so it only makes sense to be medically prepared for issues that may occur as a result of either not being where help isn't immediately available or in the aftermath of a disaster where help is there but overwhelmed.
Now, I went last night and looked at one of your YouTube videos, and this one was on heat stress and heat strokes. And you have a little bit of fun during the video, too, and I like that. You know, you're not just making it all serious and heavy. There was a lot of fun going on there. But you did pass on some really useful information, and I think some of our listeners are interested because we've had severe heat occurrences in the last couple of years, like in Texas, where it just went to 35 and stayed there every day for over a month and didn't cool down much at night. We had an incident in France where an estimated 30,000 people died because of the heat, which they were not prepared for. So what were some of the things that you discussed in that video that would help people?
Well, I think the important thing is, first, you must get the person that has been exposed to the heat or maybe in heat stroke away from the heat source. It's very simple. Most of this stuff is very, very common sense. There are times when your environment is your friend, and there are times when your environment is your enemy. And if you have someone who is suffering from heat-related illness, get them out of the sun as soon as possible. These types of people, if they're wearing clothes, you should take their clothes off. You should apply moist, if you can't drench these people in cold and cool water, then you want to at least apply moist compresses in areas where blood vessels run close to the skin to effectively deliver cool temperatures to the body core. Those areas would be your neck, would be your groin area, and would be your armpit or axillary area. These are things that are important to do. You would fan somebody if you had electricity. You use a fan to help evaporate the heat. And also, if you don't have a fan, just fan the person with a piece of cardboard if that's all you have. The one thing that's very important, though, that is very important, is that you want to elevate the feet of the person about maybe 12 inches. In other words, put them in the shock position so that you can make sure there's good blood flow to the brain. And you want to avoid giving fluids to this person unless you're certain that they're alert, because otherwise, many times, fluids will go down the wrong tube. So instead of going down the esophagus, it may go down an airway. And if that happens, you might be in worse shape than you were than when you started.
So they may be mumbling, but if they're not coherent, you're not giving them water.
I'm not giving them fluid.
Okay. Now, the other thing that you mentioned in that video that interested me is there are certain temperatures at which the person is no longer sweaty. They don't look hot necessarily. They may be dry looking. Now,
you're absolutely right. You know, at about 106 degrees Fahrenheit, which I think would be 30. The talent, you'll have to let me know.
I'm not sure either. We'll go with the Fahrenheit.
Okay, we'll go with the Fahrenheit then. Sounds good. My apologies to our friends in Europe and Australia. But once you hit 106 degrees Fahrenheit, your body loses the ability to use sweating as a mechanism to eliminate excess heat from the body. And so once that happens, the skin is hot, but it's dry. If you actually go into shock, your skin could become cold and clammy, actually, but a body core temperature will reveal the truth that you are over 106 degrees. And sometimes people go all the way up to 110 and do survive it, 110 degrees Fahrenheit, but sometimes they don't.
So it is possible to die of heat stroke.
Yes, indeed.
Well, some of our listeners believe climate change is coming, and if the electricity goes out, you've got no air conditioning. You're going to have to figure out a way to cool off. So that's one thing that you cover, but you cover a lot more than that, and you provide the materials and also the lists for people to be prepared for an emergency. Do you want to talk about your medical packs and also whether people can just use the lists without buying the medical pack?
Yeah, actually, the funny thing about our mission is that I could care less if I sell any of our medical kits, even though we have an entire line of medical kits that go from a 1 pound, 1.5 pound hiker, biker kit, that type of thing, to all the way to a large, full backpack filled with the ability to deal with multiple episodes of traumatic injury. We freely publish all the contents of every single pack that we have. And the reasons why we put things in those individual packs, because we want people to have the items that are in those packs. We don't care whether they have a pack that comes from our design, let's say. We just want them to have lots of medical supplies so that we freely publish those. We want people to take a look at that and see how it would make sense for them. And we want them to work with it in such a fashion so that the way they pack it makes sense for them. I mean, can you reach things that you need for a particular injury easily? And can you accustom yourself to putting together a pack that is organized for you and that you can act quickly with? That's the most important thing, to be able to act quickly.
Well, people stock up on food. They may stock up on self-defense, but they probably don't have enough bandages or any of those things, and they feel that they don't need to. They'll dial 911.
Well, I think that is pretty short-sighted. And, you know, I know a lot of people are all about the beans and the bullets, but but we are all about the bandages. And one thing I'd like to just relate to people, and this is really, really important, that you could never, ever have too many medical supplies. No matter how many people that you think that you're going to be responsible for in times of trouble or in a homestead community, there's always going to be more people that are going to knock on your door and may ask you for medical help, especially if they're aware that you have medical skills and that you have put together supplies. So always have more than you think you need. Remember that in any time of trouble, that excess medical supplies will be extraordinarily valuable barter items.
You know, I'm looking at this. I don't have any medical skills to speak of. I might be able to do CPR in an emergency. That's about it. So I've got a lot to learn. You must have figured out what the average person could learn. Is that what you put in your book? And if so, tell us about that.
Yes, you're absolutely. Not only do I write everything in plain English, and I essentially tell people strategies that I believe are relatively easy to remember, that can be step by step, and give them some clear indications of how they can identify some of the most common things that you would encounter in a remote setting or in a situation where you can't depend maybe on, you know, sterilized water or clean food or properly prepared food. But we also do it in such a fashion that people can feel comfortable that they can be the medically responsible person. It's all in plain English. It's all there. And the supplies that we talk about, how to use the supplies. And this is something that people really don't think that they have the potential to learn how to take care of other people, be medically responsible for themselves and for other people. But this is something that's very, very basic. And most of the issues that you can deal with medically in a disaster situation are things that are well within the non-medical professional's grasp. There are situations that are not going to be within the thoracic or trauma surgeon's grasp in some situations where the grid is down. You know, some chest wounds, things like that, are just not going to be survivable, or brain injuries are not going to be survivable, even with the best of skills. And we have to understand that, and I'm very realistic about that in the book as well. So I'm not suggesting to people that they're going to have miracle cures of major traumatic injuries, but I will want to give them the best chance of getting their patients to recover from survivable injuries.
Why aren't we taught these things in school? How did we come into a culture where we're so separated from looking after our own bodies?
Because we are in a culture in which we're not responsible for most of the services that we receive. We're not responsible for doing just about anything for ourselves anymore. And so as a result, when modern technology is available to us, you know, it's very easy for us to allow a small number of people to be in charge of that technology. And when they're in charge of that, a small number of people are in charge of these things, then other people feel that, well, we are actually in good hands. And you are. I mean, most of the people that take care of us, you know, medically or have the best of intentions. I'm not saying that they don't, but I believe that it's just very important to take some responsibility yourself as well.
Yeah, I think as a parent, that would be one thing. And a lot of parents do. They try and get some little handbook that they can have on the shelf at least and recognize if this child is in serious need of help or not. It's something we should do as parents. Do you feel that you have been put in a fringe category because you're coming out and speaking out on this?
I have had some criticism from the medical establishment for what we're doing, but I really consider this to be a mission, and this mission is to allow people to have a chance to protect their family medically in situations where we cannot depend on medical help to be, or modern medical help to be readily available. And there are many circumstances where that is the case, and we just don't realize it. As far as I'm concerned, I will say that I've actually had as many physicians support, you know, my views as I've had physicians criticize my views. As a matter of fact, many physicians are people that buy our medical kits. So I'm actually gratified to hear that from some. But from my standpoint, I really don't care if there is criticism. I really feel that it's important, very important, for people to become better medical resources for their families, for their loved ones in the event of disasters or in remote settings, because if you don't do it, then no one else will.
So please, Joe Alton, tell us the name of your book and your website so people can follow up.
The name of the book is The Survival Medicine Handbook, When Help Is Not on the Way. And we are at www.doomandbloom.net, and you'll find over 300 articles on medical preparedness absolutely free on the website.
I'm going to try and educate myself. Thank you so much for being on Radio EcoShock.
You're so welcome.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.